Such an honor to have my next guest on the show, Neil Gang. He's the chief of police in Pinole, California. He's also a keynote speaker on officer wellness and creator of the Asher model. Chief Gang brings a solid reputation for strong work ethic, excellent communication, perceptive listening, common sense, problem solving, and relationship building. Chief Gang is a trailblazer. In order to serve our community better, we need to be taking better care of the brave men and women who serve us every day. Grab a pen, grab a paper, take some notes. Chief Neil Gang, next on the Criminal Justice Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Patrick here, host and creator of the top-ranked Criminal Justice Evolution podcast. Top rank because of you, the listener and supporter. Thank you so much. If you haven't already, please head over to Apple Podcasts. Give us that 5-star rating and review. We sure would appreciate it. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. We know you're going to love the show, the content, the guest. If you're a long-time listener, welcome back. And again, thank you so much. A big shout out to all those brave men and women working in the criminal justice field. Whatever you were doing, wherever you're at, thank you for doing it. Remember this, you are honored, cherished, and above all, you are loved. Keep up the fantastic work.
Do you know someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything. Stop the drug and alcohol nightmare. Are drug and alcohol problems hitting you too close to home? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything.
800-210-7907. 800-210-7907. 800-210-7907. That's 800-210-7907.
Such an honor to be partnered with an amazing and innovative company like Detecticam. This company is helping keep our brave men and women safer by offering mobile threat detection that fits in the palm of their hands, detecting illicit drugs, explosives, now COVID-19. Folks, this application-based technology is a must-have for your organization. Head over to cjevolution.com, see the link to Detecticam, and see how they can help keep your troops safer. I love my coffee. I love my products from Four Sigmatic. I'm a huge fan of this company. I love my Lion's Mane Mushroom Coffee. I drink it every day. It gives me that energy, that clarity to get me through my hectic and busy days. Head over to cjevolution.com. See the link to Four Sigmatic. You are going to love their products. Everything from coffees to elixirs to cocos. They have it all. And you're going to get 15% off of your purchases using the promo code CJEVO. On to this great episode with Chief Neil Gang. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have my next guest on the show, Neil Gang. He is the chief of police in Pinole Police Department in the Bay Area of beautiful California. Sir, thank you for being here. I called you sir again. I'll call you Neil. Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you so much, Patrick. I'm honored and blessed to be on this program. I've been following you for a little while. You've done some great work, and I'd imagine you're going to continue to do good work and influence people and influence the professions that you work with. And thank you so much for having me.
Well, I appreciate it, Neil. And I'm only as good as a guest, and I'm blessed to have great guests like you come on the show. The whole purpose of the show, as you know, Neil, is to kind of give back to the law enforcement community, brave men and women who are out there every day in this very difficult profession. So I always asked guests, especially Leo's, Neil, what got them into law enforcement? So for you, what drove you to law enforcement in your family, or what was the catalyst?
So you're probably going to want to get a pen and take some notes. It's pretty inspiring.
Okay.
I didn't want to go to school anymore. I got hurt playing college football, and I decided to come back to town where I was residing and take the police test. Never wanted to be a police officer. Never thought about being a police officer. And I got to the point where I had two options, get myself a full-time job or go back to college. And at that time, I did a little bit of studying about what I thought would be a good fit for me, and sitting behind a desk, oddly enough, here I am sitting behind a desk, but was not something that I felt I could be successful with. And somebody recommended taking a police test, and I said, sure, why not? Never thought I would get hired. And actually, I was one of two selected out of 350 applicants at the time in West Windsor, New Jersey, which is right outside of Princeton. And 32 years later, here I am sitting behind a desk talking to you.
Wow, great career, and we thank you for your service, Chief. And what, so much has changed, and I know we're going to talk about it, but so much has changed in law enforcement in your 30 plus years, has changed in my career. I mean, where do you think, you know, the profession is heading? There's a lot of uncertainty and things like that, but from your lens, from your chief of police, 30,000 foot lens, where do you think the profession is heading? And that's probably a broad question, and I know that, but there's a lot of uncertainty out there, but I think the profession is very resilient, like we're going to talk about. I think we're going to come through this, but from your view, Neil, where do you think we're going?
So I think you mentioned it's a really difficult question to answer because there's so much uncertainty.
Yeah.
We're in this really, really difficult season in law enforcement right now. Now, I think you and I probably came up around the same time, you know, where it's a paramilitary structure, mm-hmm. you know, in the 80s, you had autocratic type of leaders. And then slowly through time, and certainly through my time in 30 years, it's really transitioning into like a business model mm-hmm. where we're not even police chiefs anymore as a paramilitary structure. It's more of a CEO of a business,
yeah.
right? The people we deal with are our customers now. We worry about our branding, our messaging to social media. So where are we going? I think we're going to continue to move in that direction where it's more of a business model, and we're going to have to get quality people that understand that this profession is really about having a servant heart. And if you're not in this profession with a servant heart to serve and lead people, it's going to filter you out of this profession. And maybe it's not a bad thing. Yep. Maybe this transition we're going through is really going to give us stronger, better policing in the future.
Yeah. One of the things I see, and I know you do being the chief of police, is recruiting issues and retainment, you know, obviously attrition rates. So I talk to a lot of people in law enforcement that are in my area that are just having a tough time, as you know, Neil, just getting qualified people. People are getting out. I know a lot of officers that are looking for an exit ramp, and for a variety of reasons, some retirement, some other reasons. But what can we do better in law enforcement or law enforcement departments and, you know, do better to kind of recruit and get good people in the door?
Well, I think that one of the struggles is going to be what everybody sees in society.
Sure.
You know, I can go into a profession right now and make the same amount of a lot of police agencies around the country, make a lot more money, work less hours, and not have the scrutiny that we have now. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a challenge, right? Regardless of how we move forward. I think we need to start hiring and start looking for people that maybe just weren't like geared towards military or geared towards wanting to be a police officer. I'm going to take you back about early 90s. Do you remember the airline, the Eastern Airlines?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They would fly up and down, and I would take them all the time from New Jersey, where I grew up, down to Florida to visit my grandparents. Well, in the 90s, when I got to Pembroke Pines, Florida, where I was working, they went bankrupt. And you know what happened was some smart leaders in our profession said, look at this crop of people out there, right? They know how to multitask. They understand what community service is all about. They understand what customer service is all about. Let's start bringing some of those type of people into our profession. And we got a lot of successes from that. So now when I became the police chief here, I remember my first recruitment. And I had the previous chief was involved in that. And he said, hey, we're going to look for some officers. Here's the list that I already picked for you to pick out as I was transitioning in. And it was it was people that were post-military people, right? And great people to pick. And he started saying, okay, let's look at this. Well, I went through that recruiting class and I said, there's some people here that understand the new era of policing, this era of, you know, we're going out and we need to serve the public and we need to understand customer service and be able to multitask. And then I started bringing in some other applicants. We started casting a wider net. And you know where I find great recruits? Baristas.
Oh, wow.
Servers.
Yeah.
Like that. And we've really found some great successes. So the short end of that question is we need to cast out our net a little bit further than what we have traditionally and just not assume that a certain profession is going to translate into being good police officers and understand that if we go out wide and we look for character, and we look for attributes as opposed to a specific model of what we're looking for, I think we'll have better successes.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, casting, like you said, you know, I mean, casting a wider net. Why wouldn't we? You know, why pigeonhole our, you know, and I'm not knocking the military, I know you're not, but just kind of looking at, oh my God, you know, I think there's like, I don't know what the percentage is, but I heard it's a fairly large percentage of people that are in law enforcement are prior military. So why don't, like you said, cast a wider net? I mean, what do you think about, because I know a lot of departments, Neil, you know, they're doing a lot more educational requirements. I'm not knocking education. I think education is very important. What about departments that have a four-year degree requirement? Do you think that they should stick with that, or do you think they should kind of lower it to get more of a, you know, cast a wider net, or what do you think about that?
So let's talk about that for a moment. I'm glad you brought that out. You know, the definition of insanity is, right? The same thing over and over and expect a different result.
Yeah.
Well, we've been recruiting the same way since the 60s, the 70s, and we're expecting a different result. But so when we talk about looking for potential candidates to get into the law enforcement profession, do we care that they have tattoos? I mean, most people, the generation now, have tattoos. That used to be a restriction, right? You couldn't have any visible tattoos. So that's things we got to get over. We have to get over the fact that they're not, like I said, not from the military. We have to get over the fact that some people just don't have the opportunity to get educational requirements that are necessary. So I'm a firm believer that recruit for the qualities that you're looking for, the attributes you need. All those other things are superficial. I certainly believe that it's, an education is a good thing to have, and certainly gives you an opportunity to maybe to open some more doors. But let's not restrict people from coming into our profession because they don't have a degree. And can I just share a little story about that?
Go ahead, sir.
Well, I've been a single father for many years, with full custody of two kids. I had a 4-year-old and a 10-year-old when I got separated. I wasn't able to move up in my own organization because we had a police chief in place that just felt and was strongly convicted that I needed a degree to move any further. Well, I just didn't have the time. It wasn't out of, I was not willing to go to school. I just didn't have the time. I was going to one school at night. I was taking online classes, yet I couldn't move up in my own organization because I didn't have a degree. Well, that's when I decided to go, I'm going to go out. And sometimes you have to go out to go up. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get a police chief job without a degree. So since that time, I did go back and get my degree because it was just a personal goal of mine. But I certainly don't think we should restrict people from getting into a profession or promoting up the ranks just because they don't have the degree.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, so many people, when I was doing recruiting, you know, we had to turn away because they were great candidates, but they didn't have that piece of paper. And I agree with you 100%. Some of the best cops I ever worked for didn't have college degrees or work with. And so, again, I agree with you. We need to be a little bit more open with, you know, getting, just casting a wider net, like you said, Neil. What do you think about, you know, because we've always struggled, at least in my neck of the woods, struggling and having a diverse police force, like having a mix police force, African Americans, Hispanic officers. What can we do to, you know, ramp up, or maybe ramp's not a good word, generate more interest in, you know, the African American community, you know, the Hispanic community? Because I know in my last department, it wasn't diverse, and it's not the department's fault necessarily, but it's just, you know, where you're at. So, but what can departments do to kind of recruit more, to be more racially and culturally diverse in their organizations?
Well, I think that, Patrick, that's such a huge part of what we do as leaders in our profession now. And I think that's where a lot of our profession fails to recognize the need for our police forces to be reflective of the communities we work in. Again, go back to tradition. Where do we recruit? We go to college fairs, right? We'll recruit, you know, in regular maybe police chief magazines. Well, again, if we want to get a diverse group, we need to recruit diversely. Mm-hmm. We need to go into those maybe underserved communities and look for people. We need to recruit maybe at the high school level as opposed to going to college fairs. We need to go out and look for qualified people to do this job and join us, to be partners with us in the communities in which they're at. And I'm a firm believer that we need to be proactive in that and to be able to get diverse people for our police forces.
Yeah.
I think we've probably failed as a profession over the years to really be proficient in that. And I think it's because of, we're so locked into, this is how you recruit. You know, what do you throw on your website, right? You throw a recruiting video where it's the SWAT guys throwing flashbangs that are running around with AR-15s. But is that really reflective of our law enforcement profession? It's really not. So make your recruiting videos reflective of what you do, you know, and if you emphasize what's important to your department with your abilities and the values of your agency, I think we'll get more people that are willing to step into this profession. And certainly it will take some effort on the leadership of the profession to do so.
And I know I mentioned, Neil, that a lot of officers that I know are getting out for a variety of reasons, you know, retirement, maybe they moved to, you know, they just want out or whatever. I know the one of the things that keeps coming up a little bit is the erosion, depending on where you're at, of qualified immunity. What do you think about that, Neil, and being the chief of police and your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's funny that that's a lot of discussion on qualified immunity. Well, if you really dive into that, and I'm not a legal expert in any stretch of the imagination, but qualified immunity helps officers that are in policy in the law, right? Mm-hmm. But what everybody's trying to make a broad statement is that it helps everybody. Well, if you're breaking the law, qualified immunity doesn't apply.
Yeah.
If you're out of your policies and out of your training, qualified immunity doesn't apply. So for the officers that are out there, and we're not going to sit here and say that all officers, there's not a percentage of officers that maybe just are not fit for our profession. And the good police officers, the good police leaders don't want them in our profession. Mm-hmm. But if they're breaking the law and there's going to be charges, then qualified immunity doesn't even apply to that. So to take away qualified immunity to the officers that are doing the right things for the right reasons, for the right purposes, I feel that's a mistake for legislation to move in that direction.
Yeah. And I think that's, like I said, I think that's a big worry. And I agree with you. I mean, some people don't know that it's qualified immunity is not going to protect you if you're out there doing bad stuff. But like you said, Neil, I think people that I talk to and I, you know, over the last couple months or last year are worried that we're going to just get rid of it. And you know, officers are going to be held liable personally now. Even good officers out there making mistakes, we all do, you know, as things happen. And then they're going to be held personally responsible or monetarily liable for mistakes made on the job.
Well, I think that we're in a really interesting season in our profession. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of emotional rhetoric out there. And I'm not going to get into politics, but there's a lot of different things that are being said. I don't see that going away. And again, if the idea is that we want to be able to prosecute officers for doing bad things, well, that can be done right now. It has nothing to do with qualified immunity. Yeah. Because again, qualified immunity does not apply if you're breaking the law or doing things outside your training and policy. So I'm not really seeing the correlation there, but it just sounds really good for the people that are trying to change.
I'm having the same thoughts you were, but it's interesting how people get on a topic and they just kind of run with it. So now, go ahead.
Isn't it the same thing with defund the policing movement? Yeah. I mean, it's great, but when you talk about reallocating funds, I mean, I'll raise my hand. I don't want officers responding as first responders to mental health calls if we don't have to. But when you say defund the police, that's only part of the sentence. The other sentence is fund what? Because the need and the calls aren't going to go away. Who is responding to them is what we need to talk about. So defund the police department, okay, but fund what? Yeah. Right? So it sounds like it's a half sentence to me.
Yeah. And it's interesting you brought that up, Neil, about, because I'm with you. I don't, and I know this is a hot topic with some departments and administrators, but, you know, having, you know, our men and women, first responders, law enforcement responding to people in mental crisis, things have changed dramatically since I was a police officer. We would respond maybe, you know, once in a while to somebody in mental crisis. Now it's almost every day, at least where we're at or I'm at. I never thought we'd be administering Narcan to people that were overdosing. So how do we, I know it's probably, it's a broad question, but how do we kind of pull back on that and stop putting that burden on our, you know, first responders, the you know, the people on the front line? Because I agree with you. I don't think we should be going to all these mental health calls and things like that. And it seems like over the years, it was just thrown at us. We just said, all right, we'll go ahead and do it. As law enforcement's always like the, you know, the people that are just, you know, handling everything. And, you know, it's just more and more and more every year.
Well, I think part of that is we're open 24/7.
Yep.
And historically, if we don't have an answer as to who's going to handle it, it always fell back on police departments historically. So I think there needs to be a lot of heavy lifting to be done with that. I think there has to be some education. I think that there's going to have to be some federal funding to kickstart some programs. There are some programs out there now. There's a program called CAHOOTS, out of Oregon, where mental health professionals are first responders. I think it's going to take some time to see if that model will actually work. I more think that I could see a model where it's a co-respondent type of event, where you have an officer who also goes with a mental health professional. And it doesn't have to be in the same car, but you may have to go to the same scene and wait for the mental health professional to go in and share responsibilities there. So I don't think there's really any great answer right now. I think it's going to take a lot of money. It's going to take a lot of training. And certainly it's going to change a lot. It's going to be a paradigm switch into our profession.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, we just can't go on the we've been doing the same thing for so long, as you know, Neil. And that's a good segue into to officer wellness. I know you speak a lot on officer wellness. You created the Asher model, which I'd love to talk about. 2019 was a horrible year. Every year is bad. Anytime an officer takes his or her own life or is killed in the line of duty, it's a horrible incident, obviously. But officer wellness, it seems like, again, it's getting, again, perception. More and more officers out there are struggling with depression, PTSD. So how do we get a grip on this, Neil? I mean, how do we, I mean, there, I agree, we were talking beforehand, and I agree with you. I think there's a lot of talk out there, but then there's people like you that back it up with action. You know, 2019 was a horrible year for officer suicides. It seems like, you know, more and more officers are depressed, suffer from PTSD, you know, taking their own lives. So how do we get a hold of this, Neil? I know you do, you have a keynote, you talk about officer wellness. You also created the Asher model, which is amazing. We were talking about it before we started, but I think there's a lot of lip service out there from some organizations, some leadership, but you're one of the leaders that, that's why I'm glad you're on here, but that back it up with action. So, you know, how do we try to get more word out and more awareness with officer health and wellness?
You said a lot there. So let me unpack that a little bit. You're right. 2019 was a really bad year. You know, estimated 228 officers died by suicide. The sad part, and people don't think about that for a moment, but let's pause, you know, to let people think about this for a moment. They say that that number may be underreported by a factor of 2.5.
Yeah.
So think about that for a moment. Over 500 officers died by suicide. That is, it's a tragedy. It's a epidemic that we need to address. One of the concerns I have with that is that we have leaders that, you know, this is like a new generation of police chiefs that are out there, that a new generation of executives that had never had to deal with it. You know, we didn't have anything role model for us. Something I call a trailblazer leadership. There's no path that was left for us. There's no book to follow. There's no playbook. But if it doesn't start with us, it doesn't start with the executives in the organization, then people aren't going to take it serious. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in officer wellness programs. I believe in officer wellness culture change. And if it's not a cultural change where it's really what you believe in and it's an organizational shift, I think it's going to fail. I think that, again, I think it's raising awareness is great. There's a lot of great partners in the profession and outside the profession willing to help. But if you don't have leaders that are going to walk the walk and talk the talk and understand that if it starts with us, and I always ask myself, if not me, then who? Mm-hmm. If it's not going to start with leaders like that, then how do we expect change in this profession? Mm-hmm. And it's going to take a long time until it changes. You know, we talk about PTSD, right? The cumulative trauma that's not dealt with leads to officer dying by suicide. But let's talk about something for a moment that people don't think about. How about finances?
Yeah.
How about finances? Typically, you're depressed. It starts stress. It starts problems in your professional and also your personal relationships. But who's dealing with your finances? Who's training our new officers on finances so they don't have that as one of the stressors? So there's a lot of work to be done. I think it has to be a multifaceted approach, has to hit multi-levels, because every single topic or every program may not resonate with somebody. But if you have a multifaceted approach and you deal with this on multiple different levels throughout someone's profession and their career, then you hope that something resonates and changes outcomes.
Yeah. Do you think, Neil, I mean, the level you're at right now, do you think there's, because I think it has changed as far as the stigma placed on officers who ask for help. Do you think it's, I guess it depends on where you're at. Do you think there's still a lot of departments out there that kind of stigmatize officers who come forward and ask for help. I know my last department was really good. I mean, we didn't stigmatize the officer. We got him or her help they needed. I mean, it could always be improved, but I know when I was a young officer, if you were in a critical incident, it was basically, all right, do your paperwork, get back on the street, and no kind of, you know, counseling or anything, any resources. And I imagine there's still departments out there that are like that.
I talk to, you know, when I speak, it's a great opportunity to speak, mm-hmm. but it's even better opportunity to network and talk to people. There are a lot of agencies. There's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah.
One gentleman I spoke to right after my one of my last presentations emailed me and basically told me that their chief's perspective is, if you can't get in a car and answer calls, you're no good to me.
Wow.
I mean, we still have leaders in our profession that feel that way. We still have leaders in our profession that didn't have role models and thought, you know, are still thinking 1980s leadership, and that's not going to work, and that's going to create more problems. But I do think there's a lot of work to be done. Don't get me wrong, I think there's good work being done, but we have a long way to go before we make really significant change when it comes to police suicide.
Yeah, and it just amazes me that, you know, leadership in some organizations is still like that. Look, people aren't knocking down the door to become cops anymore. You know that. I remember the days of, you know, applying for an agency and there'd be, you know, 300-400 people there. We're not getting those people anymore. So why wouldn't you take care of the resources, mainly the people, your capital, human capital? Why wouldn't you take care of them better? Because people aren't, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know some chiefs like this where they think, well, we'll just go to the apple tree and just pick more apples off the tree. And it just blows me away that some of these people are first, you know, surviving in the position they're in, especially in the, you know, the climate we're in, but they just have that mentality like, oh, well, you know, it just baffles me, Neil.
You know, it's frustrating for me as a chief because I hear this story all the time. It's just a different city. It's a different name. But then I start really thinking back and I think about my career. And for a moment, think about this too. I'm going to bring you into this, this thought process for a minute, Patrick, is who did we have that was role modeling those behaviors for us? Mm.
Yeah.
No, yeah, you're right. What chiefs in the 80s were role modeling that? And I don't blame them, right? But you're talking about the top echelon in law enforcement now didn't have leadership that even wanted to speak about officer wellness, didn't think they needed to speak about officer wellness. So if that wasn't role modeled for the top echelon in law enforcement today, what would we expect them to do besides Sure. fall back on what they've learned, right? So I don't hold them accountable to it. What I hold them accountable to is not being adaptable and not understanding the profession in 2020 or 2021 that we're in now,
yeah.
and not being able to change, right? Yeah, if you're not going to leave with love, then what are you doing?
Yeah, and that's what I mean is that I don't understand, and I understand where you're coming from, Neil, but I don't understand the mindset. The stats don't lie. And you even said, and that's a good point, the dark figure that we don't know about that's not reported. So it's very, we live in a data-driven society now. So it's very easy to pull the numbers and the stats and say, look, we got a serious problem here. And that old way of me thinking, that old archaic way of, you know, me just treating people like crap or whatever, not caring too much about them. That's, again, I understand what you're saying, but I mean, all you have to do is look at the data and say, oh crap, I should probably change the way no matter what they were taught as young officers and what they saw. I mean, you changed, Neil. I mean, you and I are pretty close in age, I imagine. And we grew up in a culture that it was a different culture, but you were able to adapt and change and realize that this is priority. So again, I understand what you're saying, you know, being malleable, being able to move with the times. We need to have a changing of the guard and get new blood in there in those senior positions, or we're just going to keep losing cops.
I agree.
People are going to leave the profession and we're not getting the numbers to replace them.
No, I absolutely agree. And it's in your podcast name, Evolution, right?
Exactly.
It's evolutionary change, where we have to understand that we also, there's times we have to do a need for revolutionary change, right? Yeah. One of the reasons why the profession now is struggling, because there is calls from outside for revolutionary change and we're not used to that, mm-hmm. right? And we all know that cops don't do well with change. So, but when you're talking about leadership, you're really talking about evolutionary change, and it's evolutionary from what they knew before. So I think you're getting there. You got some great leaders that are coming up through police profession, and I think we'll see change, but it's going to take a little bit of, it's going to take a little bit of time. Yeah. And then you talk about different parts of the country that are slower to adapt than other parts of the country. So yeah. I think it's people like you. I think it's people like me and a host of other people that there I could name that are out there doing this. And someone asked me, how do we change the culture when it comes to police suicide? And I say the same way we eat an elephant, right? It's one bite at a time. We change one person at a time. Yeah. We save one person at a time. Yeah. And over the course of our efforts, we're hoping that we'll see a reduction and change of outcomes.
Yeah. Let's talk, Neil, if you don't mind, about the Asher model that you created. We were talking a lot about it, or a little bit about it. I think it's amazing. I was studying it before we started. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to talk about it unless I could kind of share the history behind it.
Go ahead.
So if I have an opportunity to do that, you know, Asher Rosinski was an officer down in Pembroke Pines, Florida. Him and I were working together that. So this is back 20 something years ago, back in like 97. Asher was a great officer, highly motivated, was an ex-Marine, highly decorated Marine, father of two. And so it's 3 o'clock in the morning and my phone rings. And if you know anything about the 90s, I think we're around the same age. We didn't have cell phones, right? So when your phone rang, it rang. It rang the whole house because you probably had a phone in each room. Mm-hmm. So it startled me. I pick up the phone and this guy's screaming on the phone, Asher is dead. Asher is dead. And he says it one more time. He goes, Asher is dead. And I'm like, what are they talking about? Like I almost thought I was dreaming. And what it turned out to be is it was a squad mate who called me that said that Asher had died. And immediately my thoughts turned to the fact that he's out, you know, working an off-duty job because I knew we were off. And he died in the line of duty, which is something that we would, you know, understand that that is part of what we do. It's part of the process of being a police officer that that may happen. He said, no, you don't understand. He shot himself. And so the most profound thing happened to me the day afterwards. And what that was is we came into briefing that day. And what do you think the most profound thing that happened to me that day that changed the course of my career and my thought when it came to officer wellness? Nothing happened. Nobody was talking about it. There was no resources there. That wasn't part of the landscape of our profession at the time. There was no peer support. There was no chaplains. There was the chief wasn't in there. Nobody. Yeah. We sat down in the chair. And I remember it was so eerie that we were just, I think everybody wanted to speak, but no one wanted to speak, if you will.
Yeah.
They were afraid to speak. I remember a sergeant coming out of the sergeant's office, sitting down in front of us, looking at us, asking us how we're doing. And this rattled off our assignments. I remember getting my assignment and I'm looking around. I go, is someone going to stop and talk to us? And it never happened. I remember getting my equipment. We walk downstairs. I get my patrol car to go 10-8 and I'm sitting there and I can't believe this. Like, I think I'm a pretty strong guy, but at least I would like to have talked about this. And there was nothing. And I remember sitting there that day, and I can tell you, Patrick, I never thought about myself becoming a police chief. It never was in my cards. I never thought about that. And I said, but if I have an opportunity ever to change the way I feel right now, I'm going to do that. And it's taken me some time, and this has been on my heart for a really long time. And that's why I decided to design something that I thought maybe could make a change. And if we could do one thing to change outcomes when it comes to police suicide, then I was willing to do anything I could to do that.
Wow.
And that's why I developed this Asher model.
Yeah. And can you go through, and I know it's an acronym, Chief, can you go through it if you don't mind?
Yeah, so Asher is for Asher Rosinski. So it's a 7-point approach to a culture of wellness, and it talks about different points. And the reason why it was developed after 7 points, honestly, because I thought it visually looked good and will catch officers' attention, and it was for the 7-star badge that we wear out in the Bay Area.
Yeah,
the 7 points really kind of really fit into creating a multifaceted, multi-leveled approach. First point being awareness. We need to raise awareness, right? We have to create an environment where it's okay to not be okay, but it can't stop there. It's going to be, but we need to bring people back to okay. So saying it's okay to not be okay, is all right, but you kind of continue on to bring people back to okay, right? So we have to have those open discussions. It has to start with the chiefs of police being able to share their experiences, right? We can't expect other people to talk about their experiences if we're not willing to talk about those experiences. And then two is having a solution-focused approach. Because if you're not going to have a solution-focused approach, then why have a program for it? Mm-hmm. How are you going to expect to change outcomes unless you have that solution-focused approach? For me, I met somebody called Dr. David Black of Cortico, and they were developing an app. But so I thought to myself, having an opportunity to give our employees 24/7, 365 access in the palm of their hands to be able to call somebody when they need to, anonymously and confidential, then I saw that it was a winner. So we went and we purchased an app for them. And then 3.3 was peer support. Mm-hmm. Developing a proactive peer support team, not a peer support team to check off a box so a leader could say, I put it on my resume to create peer support, but proactive peer support, reaching out to people, meaningful peer support, being intentional with what we do with our peer support team. And then we brought on a therapy dog program as well, which helps internally and externally. You know, the sell for a police therapy dog usually is in the community, but I could tell you that we get tenfold the amount of results from internally in our dispatch center during a debrief of a critical incident. And then four was resiliency. We have to get educate our people. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to feel like trauma? What does trauma do to our body? What does sleep deprivation do to our body? Right? Educate our people in different parts of resiliency, what combat breathing is and what that is all about, what mindfulness is.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Social intelligence. No, understanding why we act the way we do or why we respond the way we do. So I think educating people in resiliency, what it means to feel like you have PTSD, the difference between PTSD and PTSI, right? Yeah. PTSI being injury as opposed to disorder. And then five is healthy habits. You know, creating an opportunity for people to eat healthy. We partner with a meal prep company who comes in and gives us healthy meals each week. So our officers don't have to go out and eat crap, but they have an opportunity to eat healthy. We created an on-duty workout program so people can come out and work out on duty,
yeah.
You know, get rid of some of those cortisol levels so they can work out and be healthy. And then six was spirituality. And some people struggle with that, building that into their program. I don't, I'm a man of faith. I'm not going to shy away from that. So whatever that looks like for each person, but certainly understand that bringing in police chaplains in and creating a chaplain program, that's part of the culture of your organization, not just a program where it's really the fabric of your organization. That's important.
Yeah.
Right. And then creating partnerships with other leaders in your community, your faith-based leadership. So you can bring them in as well. And then seven, I think I like to share a little bit of time with you on this is family.
Oh, yeah.
You know, bringing families in from the orientation process forward. And I'll ask you a question because I'll tell you what my answer was. How much did your family get involved from the time you were in the organization until the time you left the profession?
Very little.
Mine came one time. My swearing in ceremony.
Yeah. You're right, Neil. I mean, very little. Yeah, of course they're there for the swearing in, but very little involvement from families.
Yeah, you have to partner with these families. We bring them in from the orientation process forward. We give them a tour of the police department. My family never saw the inside of my building, right? We give them an opportunity to go through our real life training scenarios, the TI scenario, shoot, don't shoot. We give them an opportunity to actually go through the scenarios and actually watch their loved ones go through the scenarios. And then I meet with each one and I explain to them, listen, I need you to champion this cause. Because when they come to work, what they're going to do, they're going to mask their feelings. And we're going to ask them how they are. And they're going to say, I'm okay. Right. Isn't that always the answer?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm fine.
But we need to educate them when they're at home, when their guards are down, that if they see change in their loved ones, something that their loved ones struggling with, maybe increased addiction or chemical dependencies, or alcoholism, depression, you need to call somebody. Call our peer support. Here's our peer support numbers. Here's my personal cell phone numbers. If you see some change in your loved one and you see a red flag, we need you to champion that cause for us and let us know. And you're not going to be able to do that unless you build a relationship with these families, right?
Yeah.
And then the last thing, right before they leave my office, we have a QR code and I let them get the app just like their loved one gets. So they have all the resources at the palm of their hands, just like their employee does, their loved one.
It's amazing. I love it all, but I like what you said, Neil, about mindfulness. My life changed when I started meditating more, when I started expressing more gratitude and practicing gratitude. It really did for the better because I was on that path years ago. And I love it all, but I really, really like the meditation, the mindfulness practice. And it really kind of bothers me. At least in Colorado, I don't know how it is in California, but when officers or people are going through the police academy and I understand the curriculums are packed and our requirements and post requirements and stuff like that. But I really wish that we would, you know, start teaching like the Asher model and making that a block in a police academy. So at least, usually young people going to an academy, at least they're getting that foundation from the beginning. Instead of stepping foot into a police department, at least they would have a little bit of that foundation. Am I making sense? Because they don't do any of that. I remember, you know, I think because I was, you know, doing academy stuff and overseeing academy stuff a little bit before I left. And there was maybe an hour and a half devoted to, you know, officer wellness or resiliency or taking care of yourself. And that includes fitness. That includes nutrition, like you said. And again, I think it needs to start there too, right?
No, I agree. I think it has to start at the beginning of the profession, from rookie to retirement. So it has to be implemented throughout their careers. And I agree. I think now academies are doing, you know, the 1 hour block of officer wellness. Honestly, I don't even know what's being taught.
Yeah.
I try to reach out to some local academies and offered up my time to come in and speak. And I've been denied several times, and I won't share who that's with, but I think academy directors are a lot of them are old school leaders in the profession where they just don't see the need. Right. And I get it that you can, you know, say that the blocks are full and we don't have time. I can tell you what you don't have time for is not to make them healthy and not to talk about officer wellness, because I'll tell you right now, that's what you need in this profession. And if you're bringing people into this profession that don't understand that, we're going to continue to see the same results we're seeing today. And we're not going to make any change.
Yeah.
So I agree with you, and I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, and it's, again, going back to data, you know, the data is there. There's a reason why NFL teams, professional sports teams, elite military, I have SEALs on the show that practice mindfulness, and there's a reason why all these elite groups, you know, different law enforcement agencies are doing this, because it works. So for the agencies that, or for the people out there that think, well, you know, it's just a bunch of floating around in a robe with, you know, kumbaya, no, it works, and it can help officers who are struggling. So yeah, I agree with you. You know, probably the same people that are running the academy, some of them, you know, are they just have that mindset. But again, the data is there. It shows that it works. You can't ignore it. Well, apparently people are. And I understand, like you said, there's hour requirement stuff, but it's going to, if you invest now, you know, Neil, it's going to pay off probably, you know, in the future. You know, depositing that money into the bank, it's going to grow, right? So I think we need to start doing more, you know, as far as academy, you know, and teaching like the Asher model and other resiliency techniques, mindfulness techniques. I think that's going to help officers.
No, I agree with you, Patrick, wholeheartedly. And I'll be honest with you, as an executive in this profession, if you told me that we're going to increase the academy by 1 week, and we're going to share officer wellness, and we're going to instruct on financial fitness, and we're going to teach them how to be resilient, where do I sign up for that? You know, so 15 weeks to 16 weeks, we have to be smarter and we have to do things better than we've done in the past. You know, think about that for a moment. You know, you're bringing people into this profession that were maybe making minimum wage jobs, and you're giving them 50, 60. And if you're in the Bay Area, you're giving these young kids $80,000 to $100,000 a year. They don't know how to financially manage that. Who's going to teach them? I think it's incumbent upon us as leaders in this profession to teach them that. So where do they get that in their career? And then you wonder why you see suicides on the tail end of retirement. You spent 20 years in the profession, 30 years in the profession. And then you're like the unfortunate situation that happened in NYPD last year, where a guy spends 30 years in the profession, drives to the area where he's going to have his retirement party and takes his own life.
Yeah,
because they're not ready to retire because no one prepared them for that. And a lot of people that can, that want to retire can't, because they didn't invest properly. They didn't save properly. Yeah. Right. Everybody, you know, the profession, everybody's buying a boat. What do that year? Everybody buys a boat, you know, and then 2 years later, everybody's selling their boats, and then they're buying wave runners.
Yeah.
Right. And then the wave runners go by and everybody's buying Harleys.
Keeping up with the Joneses. I remember hearing, Neil, when I was coming up to the profession, the three B's, and one of them is probably not really politically correct, but I'll say it anyway. The things that can destroy a career: babes, booze, and bills.
Absolutely. But what are we doing 20, 30 years later? I don't know what you're doing in the academy. No. Is anything different?
No, it's not. And you bring up a good point. You know, finances is huge. It's going to bring depression if you don't have it. And I'm not saying money solves everything, but you know, if you don't have it, it's probably going to be very difficult. And yeah, you're right. Exactly right. So I understand, you know, I mean, again, the hourly requirements, but we need to spend more time, especially, you know, like you said, with these kids coming in and all of a sudden now they're getting paid, you know, a lot of money. They need to be able to, because let's be honest, Neil, I mean, the schools are failing, in my opinion. They're not teaching financial literacy and how to manage your finances and how to be an entrepreneur and how to go out, and they're teaching you to be an employee. And there's a place for that. But I agree with you, especially with our young men and women in law enforcement, we need to teach them how to be more financially literate so they can retire when they, you know, and not have to worry about it. That's not going to solve the depression and stuff like that, but that's a part of it. Like you said, I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, I think that, and that's why I talk about building a culture. You know, if the Astro model is not for you and you want to build something, then build something, but make sure it's more incumbent than just a program that you're just checking off a box. Don't do it. If you're a leader in this profession, don't do it so you feel good and you could say that you created the program. Because I'll tell you what, you know, what we do here is that around 2 years, we think that's the good time to bring people in to talk about finances. You know, I don't know, Pat, I'll raise my hand. I didn't know the difference between a 457 and a 401k. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what the benefits meant. No, what are your retirement? 3 at 50. A lot of people don't even know what that means, mm-hmm. right? So educate them. You know, do they need to have that portion of the academy? Maybe, maybe not. They're drinking from a fire hose. There's a lot to it. But certainly at 2 years after they make probation, sit down and explain what those benefits mean, right? What is, does their life insurance even going to cover their expenses when they die? I mean, those are the things that many people don't ask. And then I'll submit to you something, and I'm sure I'll get a lot of feedback about this. We talk about smashing the stigma when it comes to mental health. How about we start smashing the stigma when it comes to financial health?
Yeah.
You know, people are embarrassed. They're afraid to say, I mismanaged my money, or I have a ton of debt, or I didn't save any money, and they're embarrassed. So what happens that every year you get those little 457 envelopes, and what do? You shove it in a shoebox. You know, I had a stack of them in my career where I'd never even opened the statements monthly. I had no idea what I was doing. And honestly, to this point, even as a chief, I still need some assistance. But we have to brace that. We have to smash the stigma when it comes to asking for financial help and saying, I don't understand. I have no idea when I signed a paper after 21, what it meant 3 at 50, my retirement. I didn't know how much money that meant when I retired at 50, whether or not I'd even be able to live my life. Mm-hmm. You know, and many people do get to retirement age and they can't leave the profession because number one, they can't afford it. And they didn't plan for it. That's what I'm saying. At 2 years, we educate about financial fitness. At around 10, 15 years, we bring in retirement experts to talk about what it's going to look like long-term and what that's going to feel like, right? The isolation and the lack of adrenaline kick and what that's going to feel like and what it's going to be in 5 years when people say, I'll reach out to you and we'll still be buddies and we're still going to be friends. And you float slowly as the years pass on, that dissipates and you are by yourself now. And you don't have that sense of feeling or that brothership that you had.
Yeah.
And that's why people are dying by suicide after they retire. That should never be happening right now.
Yeah. And I always told, you know, officers that, you know, have other passions outside of law enforcement. It's okay to be passionate about the job. And I get that. But I was always looking, Neil. I mean, I knew I was going to do a career in law enforcement, but I got into teaching and education and other things. And so I always, you know, I mean, you have to be, you know, have other, like I said, other passions out there. You have to be versatile is what I'm trying to say. And so I always used to tell officers that, okay, you know, follow, if your thing is, you know, you want to start a consulting business or you want to do something on the side, do it. Because I know too many cops out there and they're great people. I love them, but they sit around and tell war stories and they reminisce about the old days and stuff like that. And they're not really living after a career in law enforcement because we're all pretty much living. Most of us are living longer, right? So have something outside of law enforcement. When I left law enforcement, I wasn't just sitting around. I planned for it. And now I'm doing other things, obviously the show, but I teach and do other things. So I always tell young officers is try to look ahead, try to look down the road across, you know, around the corner, if you can, with your life and your career, because one day this career is going to end, whether or not you retire, God forbid you get high, you know, hurt, God forbid it's something else, but it will end. So what are you going to do after that? Well, I'm young. Okay. I was young too. I woke up one morning and I was 50 and I was retiring. So it goes by like that. So I always tell, and it goes in a lot, what we're talking about, Neil, is mental health and resiliency and being happy and looking forward to the future.
Well, you hit the nail on the head, and that's why it's so important to have those, you know, those multiple levels of your program and your culture, because, you know, there are some people that are outside the profession that says, we need to talk about retirement and retirement funds at the academy level. Well, I mean, let's be honest, you're 21 years old and you just want to make it through the next test, yeah, right? Exactly. And the next scenario so you can get hired, right? To go actually do your job. They're not going to listen to retirement stuff. So, you know, you maybe at 15 years, when you got another 5-10 years left, that's when you start educating on retirement. Mm-hmm. When you have that mindset that I need to prepare for the next step, right? Financial fitness, maybe not in the academy, maybe once you get into the 2-year mark, to talk about financial health and financial fitness, what that looks like. I think we have to be strategic of where we're interjecting these type of educational systems, yeah, so people could be successful. You know, somebody, there's a lot of people that talk about sleep deprivation. Great. I mean, it's a very, very important topic. I'm not sure someone going through the academy who's up till 3 o'clock in the morning studying his 10 codes cares about sleep deprivation. Yeah. I'm 21 years old. It doesn't affect me. And that's in their mind, right? It doesn't affect me. And I'll worry about that later on in my career. But that's why I think we have to be strategic in how we present these type of programs to our employees.
Now, let's talk a little bit really quick, Neil, about you're coming out with, I really want to hit on this new podcast. I love the name, Sixth Pillar Podcast. Now, when is that going to debut? And can you tell us a little bit what it's going to be about?
Yes, I'm putting that podcast together so I can compete with your podcast.
Hey, wait, more podcasts, the better, Neil. So, but I'm looking forward to it. I love the name, and I just want you to kind of share the name, and I love the name and what it's going to be about.
Actually, you know, obviously, you know, I'm joking, but no, I think there's a lot of opportunity for people to share their story. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stories that are out there that people just don't have the opportunity. They don't know how to share their story. So I thought it would be a good opportunity since I've been doing this national speaking and I meet a lot of people and networking and they're like, hey, can I share my story with you? And I can tell you that every single time I go to speak, I learn something about something and it makes me a better person by the interactions and the mm-hmm. relationships that you build. And I'm like, man, someone has to hear that story, because if they hear that story, maybe it will change outcomes. And I'll break it back down to the Astro model. And I got a phone call sitting in my office one day, and my administrative secretary comes in and says, hey, Lisa from South Florida is calling you. I'm like, Lisa from South Florida? I go, do you have a last name? And she goes, no. And I go, okay, I'm not calling some random Lisa from South Florida from 20 years ago, because I do not want to pay any back child support or anything else. So I'm just not calling her. So she calls her back and gets the name, and it's Lisa Rosinski. And I'm like, wow. And I'm sitting in this chair right where I'm talking to you. And I sat back and I go, I never reached out to her. I never asked if it would bother her if I could use her name or permission to use Astro's name. And I was really reluctant to call. And I'll make this a little bit quicker so I can get to the point. But so I picked up the phone, and you know, she said, thank you so much.
That's awesome.
Thank you so much for doing something where you're not forgetting what he did and the efforts, but more so, thank you for speaking about this. I've tried at so many different times in your profession to speak to people about what it felt like, what it meant to be a survivor of someone who died by suicide. And I was hoping to talk to the academies. I was hoping to talk to your organization that you used to work in. And she was denied at every level, at every single level. And I said, you know what? Someone needs to hear your story, Lisa. So people hear your story. Maybe that one person who's desperate and maybe is right on the fence of what they were going to do and maybe take their own life. Here's the Lisa story and what it affected their family and their kids and all those things. Maybe, just maybe, one person won't take their own life. And I said, how can I do this on a bigger level? And I said, you know what? I'm not going to wait for change. I'm going to start creating change. And I thought that, you know, with the 21st century policing model that's out there with President Obama, mm-hmm. the sixth pillar is Office of Wellness and Resiliency. What a great name. Yeah. It ties everything together, and it'll give people an opportunity that normally wouldn't have that opportunity to share their story. And hopefully that one story may change someone's outcome.
I love it. And it's going to be a hit. I know it is, because it's good stuff. And you're going to be hosting it, which is going to be awesome, Neil. If people want to reach out to you, Chief, where can they find you? Where can they connect with you?
Yeah, I think the best place right now, I'm not a social media person, but I have a LinkedIn page. That would probably be the best way. certainly I could share an email afterwards that you could put out and people could reach out to me. And again, I'm willing to answer any questions, any calls. If somebody needs help, they can call me at any time, and I'll share a number with you offline as well, and you can share it with your listeners as well. Again, but LinkedIn would probably be the best way to connect with me right now.
Neil Gang, thank you so much, my friend, for coming on the show. A lot of great information. Everything we talked about, folks, is going to be linked up in the show notes. Neil, I'd love to have you back on the show. I could talk with you all day. Thank you for your honorable service to this great profession. Keep doing what you're doing, sir. And then, yes, I'd love to have you back on in the near future.
Yeah, no, I'm blessed by the opportunity, Patrick. I love what you're doing. Thank you so much for everything you do in law enforcement. I'd love to come back because we hit on so many things that I love to talk to you about.
Yeah,
particularly
I love
the academy and the changes that need to go in the academy.
Yeah.
I wish you to stay safe, stay healthy, and definitely, most of all, stay resilient, and God bless.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.